I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The diplomatic corps has been front and center in recent weeks as the impeachment inquiry proceedings dominate the headlines. If there's one thing that's been made obvious from the hearings, it's that diplomacy is complicated. Today, a former ambassador to Portugal sheds light on the inner workings of the State Department. He'll describe the tightrope ambassadors walk between upholding the Constitution and representing a president's agenda. Then, she freed hundreds of slaves by way of the Underground Railroad. Hear how our film critics rate the big screen adaptation scene in Harriet, and get their thoughts on the independent and foreign films showing in local theaters. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Through the House impeachment hearings, the country is getting a daily lesson in the inner workings of America's diplomatic corps. Newsday reports that many diplomats these days are thrilled that witnesses such as former Ukrainian Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch are coming off as principled and courageous. They should enjoy it while they can, because the diplomatic corps has long struggled to be appreciated. Alan Katz should know. The former ambassador to Portugal has his own stories and the bruises to show for it. Alan Katz is the founder of American Public Square at William Jewell College, where he's a distinguished visiting professor of political science. He was the ambassador to Portugal from 2010 to 2013 under President Barack Obama. Alan, nice to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here.
So is the diplomatic corps having a good moment here as these impeachment hearings drag on?
Well, I think the diplomatic corps is having a very good moment. We're seeing what we often, some of us were able to see firsthand, the large number of people who spend their entire lives in the Foreign Service. They are very smart people. They're hardworking people. And they have to show, in some instances, an awful lot of courage as well. Now, my situation was sort of unique in that I was a non-career Foreign Service officer and appointed ambassador. Unlike Ambassador Sondland, I did not give anyone $1 million. Mm-hmm. But the fact is there are about 25% of the ambassadors that are appointed by any president are generally not from the Foreign Service. Now, a lot of us came out of government in one form or another. A lot of us did a lot of different things. So what you have is you have this mixture, and frankly, I think that there are some who have been appointed not out of the Foreign Service, who've done a very good job and been a great contributor. The same thing with the professionals. I think they do a wonderful job.
And you're saying that some folks become ambassadors because they make sizable campaign donations these days and they get the job as a result?
Well, I think what really happens is this. First of all, my experience,
people want the title of being ambassador, right? It's cool. It is
a wonderful job. It is, depending on how you want to go about it, it's also a job that requires a lot of time and effort and energy, which I like to think that I did when I was there. I think that there was a time, actually, if you go back in time, where large contributions, quote, bought you an ambassadorship. That kind of changed. Over time, what happened was there were people who were involved at a variety of different levels policy-wise. They may have been involved in gathering contributions, but they weren't necessarily writing large checks themselves.
Right.
And I think that what's happened really is that part of it also is, what's the vetting process that each administration puts people through? I can tell you that the Obama administration vetting process that I went through was one of the more uncomfortable times of my life.
Because
every single neighbors would be, doors would be knocked on, and they were asking about me. So it was a very thorough process.
But what do you think of this practice? Because it's happened under both Democratic and Republican administrations, where folks become ambassadors again, primarily, it seems, because of the big donations they make.
Well, let me say, I think that's sort of a mischaracterization.
Okay.
I think there's some individuals where that happens with, but I think that for the large part, a lot of us, we did other things in our lives, and hopefully we were successful at them, and we can bring some of that success and perspective to that job. We are surrounded by career Foreign Service people. It's not like the ambassador comes and brings 20 of his buddies with him.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially no one that works for you was selected by you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very interesting kind of dynamic.
You know, you hear these complaints as you read about this moment involving the diplomatic corps, again, connected to the impeachment hearings, where, you know, a lot of folks over the years, leaders of this country, going back to John Kennedy, have gotten frustrated with the diplomatic corps. They say they're too narrow-minded, too narrowly focused, and don't see the big picture sometimes. And again, I'm just regurgitating what I read.
No, I think that in many ways that's a fair comment. Depending on different circumstances. I had very good experiences with career diplomats. I had very bad experiences with career diplomats. I got very frustrated with the State Department at different times, and at other times they were of great assistance. So like most human endeavors, you have people who are, you know, and depending on your perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was there, for example, there was a big push because the Defense Department had cut back funding, and they were going to cut back the number of people at the air base that we rent from the Portuguese in the Azores, which is called Lajes.
Mm-hmm.
It was right in the midst of the financial crisis for Portugal. It was a huge problem for the Portuguese government, which landed at my doorstep on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still, by the way, my successors are still dealing with the issue. But ultimately what happened was the policy of the government was the policy of the government. And what I did was I sort of consoled myself in the end by writing a very long cable back to the State Department, sort of saying, these are what I think the consequences are of this particular policy decision,
mm-hmm.
and this is why I oppose it. But I serve as the personal representative of the President of the United States. This is the policy of the government, and my job is to carry it out.
So that's what ambassadors are. They're personal representatives of the President of the United States.
That is correct. And they are the highest that all other American personnel, all other American agencies, with the exception if you're dealing with put military aside, if you have a large military presence like in Italy or in Germany, but otherwise, every American government official is under the supervision of the ambassador, whether it's FBI or whether it's CIA or whatever it may happen to be.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so you have that responsibility and you have that authority, and it's one of those things that you just have to kind of like, you know, use your judgment that sort of says, okay, how do we move things forward? And I was interested in watching the hearings in terms of how some of these things were sort of unfolding, and it reminded me there was a time where there was a fugitive in Portugal. Who had been an American. He had since emigrated and escaped from prison. And it's a long story, and I won't bore you with all the details. But the bottom line was the Justice Department, the FBI came to the embassy. They sat down with me, and they said, this is what we would like to do. This is how we would proceed. We're meeting with the Portuguese. We want to make sure you knew about this. I informed them that I thought their efforts for extradition would be unsuccessful. But I, of course, said, this is what you want to do. That's fine. And they went forward and they were unsuccessful.
Mm-hmm.
But the point really was there was a process.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Department of Treasury, this is in the midst of the big financial crisis, not just here, but in Europe as well.
Mm-hmm.
They were very interested in dealing with those countries that had significant problems, Portugal being one of them. And what they would do, though, they began by the Treasury Department would sometimes just send people to meet with the finance ministers of those countries. And I talked to several of my colleagues in other countries, and they said it was difficult for them. And I said, well, I solved the problem. I said, I just called the finance minister and said, if anyone calls you from Treasury, just tell them you won't meet with them unless I'm involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I was over there with the Treasury people. It was all very successful in terms of these kinds of processes. But to me, it is unimaginable that the president would instruct an ambassador to work with their personal lawyer on just the story
in this
that
case,
unfolded.
Rudy Giuliani. You're
yeah, I
about.
Mean, I could not have imagined Barack Obama going to Bill Kennard, his ambassador to the EU, and saying, "You work with Bob Bauer, who's my personal lawyer, because he's got some deal going on out there, and we're doing something." It would have just been. It would have been an unthinkable kind of act.
But if you're the president's personal representative, what's so wrong with that?
Well, if you're the president, first of all, if you're the president's personal representative and you are told what the presidential policy is, the biggest problem here was that these were acts that were contrary to the policy of the United States government. Now, the president could always go to order a review and change the policy.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a process. And I think the biggest problem here is, you know, process sometimes is a real pain dealing mm-hmm. with it. And sometimes it really gets in the way of being able to get some things done.
Mm-hmm.
The flip side is the absence of process gives you just, you have no idea where things are coming from. And because you're dealing with countries that are used to dealing with the United States in a particular way, mm-hmm. when things go off the rails, they're going to draw their own conclusions. And they may be the wrong conclusions, and the people they're used to communicating with are not in the loop necessarily. All it does is sort of it creates a certain amount of it can create a certain amount of chaos.
So this notion that at least the allegations here that the president was actually all about asking the Ukraine government for an investigation to spearhead an investigation into Joe Biden's son in exchange for this foreign aid. Can you ever imagine a situation like that occurring during the years you were there?
No, actually, I was sort of talking with a friend the other day. I said, could I have imagined if there had been if Mitt Romney's kids had been on a board in some company and suddenly I got a phone call that sort of said, listen, we want this done. My reaction would have been, well, I need to go talk to someone else because this is not what we do.
Well, what would you have done?
Well, okay. If somebody
where do you go if you're Marie Yovanovitch and you're watching her testimony? What do you do if you're caught in that position?
Well, I think two things. First of all, one of the interesting things is that if you are a non-career foreign service ambassador, you generally have someone you can call at the White House. Now, I must confess, seeing that Gordon Sondland, I mean, I never, ever picked up the phone and called Barack Obama. It mm-hmm. never happened. And I knew him reasonably well. It just wasn't, I would have never thought mm-hmm. of picking up the phone to call Barack Obama. I certainly wouldn't have done it in a restaurant because from the first day I arrived in Portugal, which is sort of a sidebar here, the security people sat me down and said, you should assume that anything that is not on the top secret server that you've got in your office is being monitored.
You think that was true?
You know what? I tried to act as if it was because mm-hmm. you don't know. The other thing is you can't walk into the suite where an ambassador is without leaving your cell phone behind because they explained how technology, this is what we're talking now 7 or 8 years ago, they'd been able to turn these phones into microphones. Mm-hmm. And so therefore they could hear everything that was going on in terms mm-hmm. of people who were very sophisticated and wanting to know what we were doing. And my assumption was that whether it was the Chinese or whether it was the Russians or whoever it was, they wanted more information they could get about us, the better they liked it. And mm-hmm. this was Portugal, which essentially was very friendly country to the United States. But at the same time, you know, all the other countries are there. And so it's one of those things where you just have to recognize that the bureaucracy has created certain guardrails that, while they're frustrating at times, probably should only be breached in unusual circumstances.
Former ambassador to Portugal, Alan Katz, is my guest. He's now a distinguished visiting professor of political science up at William Jewell College. So I can't help but wonder then, Alan, what you felt as you listened to former Ambassador Yovanovitch's testimony the other day during the impeachment hearings. Did you feel empathy, sorrow, pity, what, all of that?
Well, I was very empathetic with her. I mean, I met her along the way. She wouldn't know me, and mm-hmm. I would not have remembered her if this all had not come to pass. But she had a wonderful reputation throughout the State Department as an absolutely top-notch professional. Mm-hmm. And really what happens is this, is that whatever my disagreements were with the State Department, and there are a series of cables that would underscore what they were, but the reality was, for the most part, certainly the people in the field at the embassies, people who are career people who are out there, these people were really very good. They all learned the language of the mm-hmm. country that they're operating in. So some of these people have been in 5 different places. They speak 5 different languages, and what they've learned to do is carry out the policy of the government of the United States, whether it's the policy of Ronald Reagan or George Bush or Barack Obama mm-hmm. or Donald Trump. The idea that somehow these people are subverting anything out there is so unlike anything that I could have imagined. And there were people who that I encountered along the way from the State Department who were not big fans of Barack Obama's foreign policy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's not unique, but it did not get in the way of them doing their job.
So how do you think the president's conduct toward Ambassador Yovanovitch and others, for that matter, would affect morale among the diplomatic corps going forward?
Well, I think what happens is this, 2 things. First of all, it makes the idea of going into the Foreign Service less attractive. And getting into the Foreign Service is a highly competitive process. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know people, very smart people, who've had to go through the process 2 or 3 times before they were admitted. Secondly, if you're looking around and sort of saying, do I want to be the target of the president of the United States. And the other thing that's so interesting is that, you know, so we sit there at home and we sort of say, okay, so they said a bad tweet about her. Gee, that wasn't very nice. But what we forget is that there literally are millions or thousands of people who in various extreme positions who will then target that person in a whole bunch of really untoward ways. I mean, we heard Jeff Flake the other night.
You mean partisans around the country?
Yeah. About. I don't mean the what I'm saying is that the product of this kind of behavior it is manifest in very negative ways.
So give us a fuller sense than a typical day for an ambassador to an important company, a country like Portugal would have been what, Alan?
You would start your day and you basically, you'll have a meeting with your senior staff and you'll find out what's going on in the country. And we were in the midst of the financial crisis. So the question was, were there going to be demonstrations? Was a snap election going to be held? Mm-hmm. And you would talk and basically your day would have a series of people that wanted to talk with you. Sometimes it was from the government of Portugal. Sometimes it was visiting Americans. That you'd have a congressional delegation that would come through, and the question is, okay, fine, are we going to have lunch with them? What are we going to talk about? What are they interested in?
Right.
Someone from my regional security officer would want to come and say, this is coming up. We had the NATO summit in Lisbon, and so that took a huge amount of preparation and a lot of work. Mm. And in the process of while I was there, not only did we scale back on the Lodz's air base, which was bad for the Portuguese, we also closed Joint Command Lisbon of NATO and replaced it with something else. So I had my hands full with what is a friendly country, but they were in the midst of a fiscal crisis.
The Washington Post just did a piece about the diplomatic corps and pointing out to misconceptions about foreign service officers. Let's run through with some of these. One of the misconceptions, at least according to the Post, was foreign service officers are white male elites.
Two things. First of all, there are more white males in the Foreign Service, and I think that was probably a fairer characterization 20 years ago than mm-hmm. it is today. My deputy chief of mission was a woman, and she has actually gone on to be ambassador to African countries since that mm-hmm. time. I like to think that was in spite of working for me as opposed to because of. And when I got there, frankly, there were not very many women in professional positions, and we made an effort to sort of change that. But I think that's it's an evolving situation.
Another misconception, Alan, foreign service officers advance their own agendas.
I think that that's really not, that was not my experience. I'm sure there's some individuals that do, but my experience really was that was not the case. They may grumble about what the policy was, but the point was is that, you know, in fact, one of my early meetings with my so-called country team, which was the leadership of the embassy, and people said, well, this is the way we do this, and this is the way we do that, and I looked around the room, and I said, well, I think that's great, but, you know, since I'm the ambassador here, let me tell you, we're going to approach it a little differently.
Yeah.
And everyone needed to understand that.
Here's another one. Face-to-face diplomacy isn't necessary anymore.
Oh, I think that's complete nonsense. Mm-hmm. In fact, what I found to be the most effective use of whatever talents I had gained before I became ambassador was my capacity to basically create personal relationships. And by having those personal relationships, frankly, we were able to Portugal had been elected to the Security Council. There was going to be a resolution coming up that we didn't want to have to veto. They needed 9 votes to get it on the agenda. I went to the foreign minister, who I developed a good relationship with, and basically, even though he was upset with us for these other matters I've mentioned before, he kind of talked him into our camp, mm-hmm. And therefore the matter never came before the Security Council. Without a personal relationship, it wouldn't have happened.
Here's one. Diplomacy can't achieve much without the military.
Oh, I think that's also, I think the military would be the first people to tell you that's not true. And the military actually are in my case, I had a military attaché who was very helpful. We worked very, very closely with the military, and I think that they were part of what we did, but not because of the threat they represented.
This run-in you had with the Treasury Department, Alan, that all worked out the way you wanted it to?
Yeah, it was one of those situations where I think the Treasury felt a lot of pressure because of the fiscal crisis in Europe affected what was going on in the United States. So, I mean, I understood the pressures they were under, mm-hmm. but I think that in some ways they tried to sort of skip over the impact they might have in other parts of the relationship, and we were able to get that back in the bottle pretty quickly.
So where do you think the future of the diplomatic corps will be in the wake of these impeachment hearings?
Well, I think two things happened. I think that a number of these Foreign Service officers who acquitted themselves so very, very well at the hearings, I think that it will add to the sense of pride for the people that are there, because and as well it should. I think that other people could sort of see these people as heroes and therefore maybe aspire to do something like this. And I think a lot depends upon what happens with the next Secretary of State and the next president.
Yeah. That's Alan Katz, again, former ambassador to Portugal during the Barack Obama presidency. He's now a founder of American Public Square at William Jewell College, where he's a distinguished visiting professor of political science. Thanks for the insights, Alan. Sure appreciate it.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
After a short break, we'll come back and review the best indie films now showing around town. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. You can sign up for my weekly newsletter, Kraske Off Mic, for behind-the-scenes moments and my thoughts about guests and show topics. You don't want to miss it. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske. It's quick and easy, kcur.org/Kraske. Monday on the show, the CEO of the Heartland Center, the facility used to house overflow prisoners after the Kansas City ended its contract with the Jackson County Jail earlier this year. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, with a new biography and now a new movie about her life, Harriet Tubman is enjoying a much-deserved moment in the spotlight. We talked about the new book a couple of weeks ago on this program. Today, our film critics are here to talk about the new movie that depicts her work saving hundreds of lives on the Underground Railroad. Hers is a remarkable story because she was one tough cookie. Now the film critics who review the latest independent movies showing in town, and they are Cindy Haynes. Cindy, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Steve Walker, how are you?
I'm great, Steve. Thanks.
And Bob Butler's here. You can see his films and review, see his reviews at butlerscinemascene.com. Robert, how are you?
Doing great.
Okay, there's a new movie theater opening in Topeka. Cindy, what about it?
Well, it's a pleasant surprise considering theaters are closing left and right. It's the B&B Topeka Wheatfield 9, and it just opened on Fairlawn. And I guess you take 470
the south side of town.
Right, yeah. And it's right there. You can see it right from the freeway. And
this shows independent films?
No, just blockbusters. I mean, it's the latest in movie technology and screens and sound and everything. So, it's not too far from Lawrence.
Okay. Let's go to our first film today, Steve Walker. It's Give Me Liberty. It's showing at the Nelson Atkins. That's a Tivoli at the Nelson Atkins. A medical transport driver who can never say no risks his job to take a group of Russians to a funeral while he imposes upon his regular clients who must go along for the ride with some outrageous characters.
That's a mouthful, but it's true. I've heard about this movie for a while, and then it popped up on Jerry Harrington's Tivoli calendar. It's what's so interesting about this movie is that, yeah, he drives a van for people who are mostly disabled or elderly.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the cast are non-professional, disabled, and elderly people. So this filmmaker, Kirill Mikhanovsky, is my best guess, knows how to corral people because it really just comes together and it holds as this driver, Vic, trying to get these old Russian Americans. It's set in Milwaukee, right?
It is. He's got a grandfather who is on the brink of senility and practically burns his apartment down on a daily basis. And it's both a comedy and a very sobering look at aging and infirmity.
But it's done with love and consideration, and that's one of the major points of the film, is that this young man just can't say no to anyone who needs a ride or needs help or what. And it's very,
he's a really sweet hero. He's like a 25-year-old guy who's still speaks Russian with his grandfather, and he kind of has a relationship that he forms with this African-American young woman who's in a wheelchair. And you just don't know where it's going from scene to scene. It's completely original.
And so you liked it.
Oh, I liked it a lot, yeah.
Yeah. How about you, Cindy?
I thought it was delightful. I really did, and I would recommend it.
I like delightful movies.
Yeah, I like it too, and I especially like there's a character who's a bit of a con man who goes along for the ride.
Boxer. Oh,
and
yeah,
little by little, he becomes sort of like this unexpected hero of the piece. So
we have a clip here, Steve.
We do. It's the actress in the wheelchair is named Lauren Lolo Spencer. She is one of his regular patient or passengers, but she's being inconvenienced by his adoption of these older Russian Americans on their way to a funeral.
This is the film from the film Give Me Liberty. It's showing now at the Nelson Atkins at the Tivoli Theater inside the museum.
So what's going on now?
There's an emergency. I have to get them off real quick.
What's going on now?
She's not feeling well, so it's going to
take
a couple
seconds. So all of them got to get off?
What?
Michelle Boo, I'm going to see you later, okay, girl? Sorry about this morning. Who knew this was going to happen? I love how the accordion got off this van before I did, knowing that I'm supposed to be getting off here.
This is from Give Me Liberty. That sounds pretty good.
It's really interesting, again, because of the way he has cast it, and it's frenetically edited, and it takes place in 24 hours.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So three thumbs up for this film, Give Me Liberty. Let's move on to the film I talked about in the opening here, Cindy Haynes. This is the film titled Harriet, the story of Harriet Tubman, who escaped slavery and risked everything to help free hundreds of slaves who traveled on what became known as the Underground Railroad.
I think the film is being overshadowed by the fact that they were working from the philosophy, don't let facts get in the way to a good story.
Oh.
I mean, people are upset
interesting
with the way Tubman is depicted in the film. Cynthia Erivo plays Harriet Tubman and does a terrific job, I think, with what she was given. It was directed by
Casey Lemons,
who did a wonderful film called Eve's Bayou. You might want to look for that somewhere and watch it. It also features Casey's husband, Vandy Curtis Hall, as a preacher in the film.
What do you think of this film?
I wasn't overly impressed, I guess. And I wanted to be moved. I wanted to be affected. I have very mixed feelings about it.
And I have mixed feelings saying I didn't care for it that much. I mean, it's an incredible story. A film about her life has never been made in this manner. I would get teary-eyed seeing the trailer. I have to say about this actress, Cynthia Erivo, I saw her play Celie in the musical Color Purple on Broadway. One of the most amazing performances I've ever seen. She got a standing ovation after one song and the show wasn't even over.
Wow.
She's incredible.
But this film, you have issues with, it sounds like.
I have issues with the movie because the script is just seems like a series of platitudes. There's not a lot of differences between this trip and going to get more people and this trip.
I've got a great example, though, of Backstory Outrage. It came up this week. 15 years it took him to get this movie together.
Oh, at least, yeah.
And at one point, apparently, they had a producer who said he could do it as long as Harriet Tubman was played by Julia Roberts. So, folks, that's Hollywood in a nutshell.
You are kidding
me. No, that was all. That was in the news.
That's just offensive.
I want to give her a little more credit. Erivo is British, and she's already received a Tony, an Emmy, and a Grammy.
She's amazing.
And if she wins for Harriet Tubman, as playing Harriet Tubman, she'll be a...
You know, I have never understood this notion. I've always struggled with this idea that we make a film about a real-life character, and we're going to mess with the facts surrounding his or her life. And I just don't know if that's the right way to do it.
The first
because the impression people get from the movie they're going to see is the impression they're going to have of this character perhaps
forever.
The rest of their lives.
That's
and
right.
So what are we doing here?
Well, the first biography of Tubman was written in 1869, and that was loaded with,
inaccuracies?
Inaccuracy, thank you, Bob. And from that point on, it just built on itself. I read one place that she's given credit with freeing hundreds of slaves, and another historian said 70 at the max. So,
well, I get the idea that maybe the historical record is a little bit off at
fuzzy.
Times. Fuzzy,
anyway,
but
yeah.
But how much liberty do you take with the facts of someone's life?
Doesn't history get a little fuzzier every minute the clock ticks? In a way,
but how much license does that give to a filmmaker run off into the great beyond?
How truthful was Spartacus? We don't know. None of us know.
People who turn to films for history are barking up the wrong tree. It's an entertainment medium, and that is it. And
even Dunkirk or something.
What responsibility do you have to portray what happened at Dunkirk the way it happened, as opposed to making up a fantasy for the entertainment of audiences? You're disparaging the real life heroes who fought in a battle like that.
As is the case with social media, the buyer had better beware. You've got to be discerning. The filmmaker is going to tell you that my job is to entertain you and sell tickets.
Right.
And a boring movie is not going to do that.
And to follow up what I said earlier,
but
Steve,
Dunkirk's not a boring. Yeah, it takes a good filmmaker to make a good film. How can you possibly have a boring movie about a film like Dunkirk?
Well, it wasn't boring.
No,
but
it was great. Yeah.
And I want to
I've got my panel stumped here with my outrage over being a lifelong journalist here. I don't want people messing with the facts.
You're making me think too hard, and this is radio, so yes. That doesn't really work.
You're thinking on the radio, not a good thing.
And also from all the citizens of Kansas City, Janelle Monáe is in the film, which is a very small part, but it's so great to see her up there on the big screen.
And the male lead is Leslie Odom Jr., who was the original Aaron Burr in Hamilton. So this movie is stocked full of fantastic Broadway performers.
But you're suggesting that their efforts have been wasted.
Their efforts are not wasted. I think the story is very vital. Their efforts are just a little bit maligned by the easiness with which the story unfolds, as if it was an after-school special.
Okay. A bit too reverential, a bit too pedantic almost.
But do you understand why I feel horrible even
saying
sure.
that?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cindy, any thoughts about my diatribe about taking the skewing with real life moments and just jacking them up for entertainment value?
Well, you're the professional here, Steve.
Well, I'm not a professional film critic, though.
Well.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, we're going to move on here. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking with our film critics about the latest independent film showing on area screens. Let's go to a film, Motherless Brooklyn. It's set in 1950 New York. It's about a detective affiliated with Tourette syndrome pursuing the murderer of his best friend, Bob.
You know what? It's come. It played for 2 weeks.
And it's gone.
It left last night.
One of the
Steve
best
is a big Steve's a yeah. big admirer of it.
Well, I just Edward Norton wrote, directed, and stars in it, and
does a fantastic,
fantastic job.
Job.
The direction and the cinematography. I mean, you feel like you are in New York City in the '50s. I mean, it's where they got these locations and managed to cover up
cars,
New York
too,
now.
Yeah.
You know, I always think about when I see a movie set in New York in the past is like, how do they have to work really hard to remove any kind of sign of modernity.
And all the cars they had, I assume, were period cars.
Oh, yeah. No, people look for this movie. The fact that it's come and gone in 2 weeks just underscores with these littler specialized films, if you wait a week and a half, they're gone.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the film. It might be coming out on, I'm sure people can see it still in the weeks and months to come. What about the performances here?
Well, Norton is terrific as an autistic guy. And this is, you know what, you can see why he won the role. A guy who, has spasms and says things, blurts out
Tourette.
Words.
He has Tourette's.
Yeah. And it's like a feast. What makes the performance really good is that he doesn't overdo it.
He doesn't, no. The trailer does a little bit. That's why I was not crazy about seeing it, but I'm sure glad I did.
I think it's one of the best movies I've seen so far this year.
No
kidding. I thoroughly enjoyed it, absolutely.
And it's not playing anywhere in town today, doesn't sound
no.
like.
No, yeah. I went to showtimes.com this morning, Steve, to prepare for the show, and there's like, what? It's gone.
Willem Dafoe is in it. Bruce Willis
great
is in
cast.
It. We got an incredible cast here, yeah.
And based on the novel by Jonathan Lethem.
Yeah. That film, Motherless Brooklyn, not showing now, but you might want to go catch it as soon as you can when it's re-released online or even by DVD. Okay, Bob, let's go to the film. I've heard about this, some buzz about this film, Jojo Rabbit. It's a Holocaust dramedy and a World War II satire.
You know, this is a movie that's going to divide audiences like a hot knife through a stick of butter. I've heard people say this is the best movie of the year. I found it to be intriguing, but ultimately unsatisfying. Here's the story. 1943, 10-year-old Johann, known as Jojo, is a member of the Hitler Youth. His dad is allegedly off fighting somewhere, although that may not be the case. And Jojo goes to... Jojo has invented a friend, an imaginary friend, to get him through life's vicissitudes, and it is none other than Adolf Hitler himself, who was played by the writer-director, the Kiwi auteur Taika Waititi, whose most recent work was pretty much out there in the comedy, total comedy vein, What We Do in the Shadows and Thor Ragnarok and TV's Flight of the Conchords. Anyway, the premise of this is that little Jojo, a fiercely... He wants to be a Nazi so bad, although it works against his better nature. Discovers living in the eaves of his family's home a Jewish teenager, a girl that obviously his mother has given shelter to. And over the course of the film, Jojo has to decide what he's going to do about her. His first inclination is to turn her in, but that would get mom in trouble. So he decides to grill her and pick her brain so he can write a book that will be an expose of Judaism and raise him in the, you know, his Hitler fantasy will approve of this. So you've got this sort of Huck and Jim thing where he's slowly humanized by his knowledge of this girl. My issue with the movie, it is both on occasion wildly silly, and at the same time the war scenes, the scenes of atrocities are brutally realistic. I found the two fought each other.
The juxtaposition just didn't work.
Didn't work for me. Now, guys, hit it.
I think the tone is kind of all over the place. I liked it better than you did. The boy who plays Jojo's name is Roman Griffin Davis. It's one of the better child performers I've seen in a long time.
He's wonderful. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, and Scarlett Johansson plays the mom in... And the film does a great... Sam Rockwell, though, for me, steals the
A one-eyed the war veteran who can strike a heroic pose, but he's got a boyfriend.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to add.
Well, he's emerging as one of our great character actors.
He is. Oh, right.
Yeah, I mean, that's without any question here. Yeah,
yeah, he's very funny.
What's the clip we have here, Bob, from Jojo Rabbit?
Well, let's see. This is where Jojo, he has been... He's at Hitler Youth Camp, and he's been challenged to show that he's a good Nazi. He's told to strangle a rabbit, and he can't do it. So he runs off into the woods where he converses with his pal Adolf.
Poor Jojo. What's wrong, little man?
Hi, Adolf.
Want to tell me about that rabbit incident? What was all that about?
They wanted me to kill it.
I'm sorry. I couldn't.
Don't worry about it. I couldn't care less.
But now they call me a scared rabbit.
Let them say whatever they want. People used to say a lot of nasty things about me. Oh, this guy's a lunatic. Oh, look at that psycho. He's gonna get us all killed. I'll let you in on a little secret. The rabbit is no coward. The humble little bunny faces a dangerous world every day, hunting carrots for his family, for his country. My empire will be full of all animals. Lions, giraffes, zebras, rhinoceroses, octopuses, rhinoctopuses, even the mighty rabbit. Cigarette?
Oh, no thanks, I don't smoke.
Because he's nine.
That's from Jojo Rabbit. It's kind of a mixed set of reviews here for that film, if I'm hearing you all correctly here this morning.
I will say that late in the film, there is a scene with a bunch of Gestapo guys who have invaded the household, and you think, oh, the jig is up, something terrible is going to happen. They get so hung up on the proper etiquette of yelling Heil Hitler at each other that they forget what they're supposed to be doing there. It's a Mel Brooks moment that really really worked for me.
Yeah, the absurdity works really well.
That film again, Jojo Rabbit. Okay. If you're just joining us again, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking and offering you reviews of some of the best indie films showing around town right now. We're going to get to several more that have gotten a lot of attention of late, even some that might not quite fit the category of independent film. We'll talk about Martin Scorsese's The Irishman, and how about A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood starring Tom Hanks. That's coming up in just a moment here. Let's get to Parasite first, Cynthia. You're not a parasite. That's the title of a film, Parasite. It's a dark social satire from South Korea that addresses the chasm between the haves and the have-nots. Steve?
I'll take that. Yes, it's Bong Joon-ho, who made Okja a couple years ago, one of my favorite movies of that year. He made Snowpiercer. He's one of South Korea's most astute and accomplished filmmakers, and Parasite will probably be my favorite movie all year.
No kidding.
And it's doing so well for a film from South Korea, subtitled.
We both went to a screening in the middle of the day, 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah,
it was
packed.
The theater was packed.
You're kidding me.
It's playing on 6 or 7 screens. Let's get to the movie, but it's amazing how well this is
doing.
How
does word spread about? I haven't.
Well, I asked the people sitting next to me, and they go, "Well, we knew his other films," and I said, "What brought you to this?"
Wow.
But anyway, income inequality in South Korea. I mean, every country has it, of course. And the way he addresses it is he has a poor family who live in a basement, folding pizza boxes is their way of life. Eventually infiltrate themselves into the lives and home of a rich family. The teenage son starts as a tutor. A friend of his is going on studying abroad and says, I'll get you this tutor gig. His sister comes in. The rich family doesn't know they're related at all. She becomes the art therapist, which she says, I had to Google what it is. I don't know what it is. The chauffeur. The kids get rid of the chauffeur. Dad becomes that. The maid is kind of dispatched in a way that's pretty funny. Or we think she's been dispatched. She has not, actually. Mm-hmm. And so their mom becomes the maid. And so they're living in this life of luxury, although, yes, they're living servitude.
Mm-hmm.
But it just keeps going and playing off these contrasts of what they think the rich live like. The rich have their opinions about what the poor live like and mm-hmm. are like. The contrasts are just amazing. It's very funny at times, and it gets really dark.
It's somewhat autobiographical. He mentioned that when he was younger, he worked as a tutor for a wealthy family.
Oh, really? Huh.
And he said this idea of class disparity began when he worked on Snowpiercer.
Mm-hmm.
And so this has been in the back of his mind for quite a while. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes, which is really a big deal.
Well,
so,
Steve Walker just called this the best movie he's seen all year.
Yeah, Cindy, probably is.
Is it for you?
Oh, yes. I'd put it in my top five.
And why?
Thought-provoking, entertaining. Great performances. Important issues are addressed in this film in a way that we haven't seen, you know, in too many films.
And it's
so
wonderfully, wonderfully crafted, wonderfully written. Even though we're reading subtitles,
mm-hmm.
he's a storyteller. He's a great storyteller.
He really is. The cinematography is just perfect.
So big thumbs up for this film. Again, it's titled Parasite. It's showing
several places. Alamo, the Fine Arts, but also several AMCs and Liberty Hall.
There's a reason to live for you as we get through.
I would want you to go see it, and I want to hear what you think.
Yeah, okay. Just a quick note, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has renamed the foreign language Oscar the Best International Feature Film. With a predominantly non-English dialogue track. What should I understand about that?
Well, they've been fighting about this for a long time, and how much of a foreign language has to be in the film, how much of it in English. If there's too much English, then it doesn't qualify. So they're trying to even the field right now.
Okay. Well, let's go get some quick thoughts on a couple of other films of note that are playing right now. Martin Scorsese's The Irishman. It stars Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. It's a 3.5-hour film, and I'm wondering, What'd you all think? A lot of buzz about this film because it's Martin Scorsese.
Well,
it's,
and we weren't going to talk about it because its budget was $160 million and
right.
paid for by Netflix. And so it's not an indie. It doesn't fit our genre of show. But it's a Martin Scorsese movie, as Bob pointed out, and probably one of the better art films playing out there.
Mm-hmm.
3.5 hours to me when it was, I was dreading it. That's a long time.
Long haul.
And when it was over, I went, that was 3.5 hours.
That was exactly my reaction. I had no trouble getting through
it. De Niro was incredibly good.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Pesci, maybe even better.
Yeah.
Pacino as Hoffa. Pacino is kind of a ham, and he has been lately. But
the film is about what, Bob? What is this story about?
In part, it's about the passage of time, about and looking back on one's life. This isn't a typical Scorsese gangster movie because he isn't trying to entertain us.
Yeah, there's none of the violence is ancillary.
The violence is almost beside the point. You've got a lead character who is not emotive. He's a man who keeps it in, and the last scene is him dealing with a priest, and he's going to go to the grave with his with his sins unredeemed.
And I struggled with Robert De Niro's character because he didn't emote all that much, you wanted him to struggle more with his as he reconciled his life and what he had done.
This is the it's the art film gangster movie in which. The thrills, the romanticism of the gangster movie are kind of turned inside out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you see them for who they really are.
You see them as people who, you know, are kind of in kind of a dirty business, doing ugly things and trying not to think much about it.
But, right. I was going to say, De Niro pays a huge price for it, but you don't get a sense that he's struggling to reconcile himself with what he's done.
He is what he is.
Yeah.
That's it. He seems to be born to do this.
Enough for a 3.5-hour film?
Well, in my opinion, no. I do not think it's a great movie. I thought it was a good movie. I did not think it was a great movie. I wanted more. There wasn't anybody there that I really identified with in any way, and I can't say that about other Scorsese gangster movies.
And we have to say that the guy De Niro's playing is rumored to be, alleged to be, the guy who killed Hoffa.
Yes.
Which, of course, we don't know.
Yes.
For sure.
He claimed he did it before he died. But
The question is movie theater or sofa at home?
I'd go sit for 3.5 hours. I'd go see in a theater, but that's me. How about A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood starring Tom Hanks?
It's another movie that really isn't indie, but guys, last year we had the Mr. Rogers documentary. It blew people away.
Yes.
Do we really need this? Well, in a way, we kind of do. This is not a retelling. This is not a retelling of Mr. Rogers' life. It's based on a journalist who interviewed Mr. Rogers for Esquire magazine,
right.
And he's played by Matthew Reese, who is star of the Americans on TV.
Yeah.
He's a guy with a chip on his shoulder, family issues, and Mr. Rogers, played by Tom Hanks, changes his world.
And you liked this film?
I liked it a hell of a lot.
You liked it?
I did not see it.
Okay. We're going to leave it right there. I want to thank Steve Walker, Cindy Haynes, Bob Butler for their good reviews here. Monday on the show, the story of how Kansas City became home to its professional sports teams and the rivalry with Oakland that helped shape the athletic scene that we know today. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.